Jacques Cousteau once dubbed the Sea of Cortez the aquarium of the world. It separates the Baja Peninsula from mainland Mexico and was then home to thousands of species. But it's now being completely emptied of life by a combination of small fishing boats and large industrial trawlers. In an article in the August issue of Harper's Magazine called Emptying the World's Aquarium, The Dismal Future of the Global Fishery, Eric Vance explains that what's happening in the Sea of Cortez should be seen as an early warning signal for all of the world's oceans. I'm very pleased that it brings Eric Vance via phone from Mexico to our show today. Welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Is this a story in Mexico?
No, it's not. Mexico, traditionally, all the big cities in Mexico tend to be inland, and a lot of the political focus doesn't tend to look towards the coasts. So this is not something you hear a lot about, though on the coast it certainly is something that fishermen and local people are acutely aware of.
Jacques Cousteau was familiar with all of the world's oceans. What was so special about the Sea of Cortez that would cause him to give it that nickname, Aquarium of the World?
Well, two things, really. The first thing is, I mean, it's obviously in its lower regions, it's very clear, and there's just a phenomenal, or in his day, there was a phenomenal bounty of life in the water. So that was sort of, I mean, you go underwater and you feel like you're just sort of wandering through an aquarium. Also, there was something to the notion of the Sea of Cortez is a manageable size to think about. It's not the Andaman Sea. It's not the Mediterranean Sea. It's a small enough sea that you can wrap your head around it, but it's also big enough that it acts like a sea. And that's also why I chose it for this story, because it was something that the reader could sort of conceptualize.
Well, isn't it also called the Gulf of California?
It is. It is. They're the same thing, the Gulf of California and the Vermilion Sea by maybe some older folks might remember that name. And it's all the same thing, which makes it kind of confusing because the Gulf of Mexico is on the other side of Mexico.
Because it has such a strange shape, it's long and thin. Is there more biodiversity there than some other places? It's kind of like a Madagascar of the oceans.
That's a really good analogy. It's located sort of in between where the oceans would normally change temperature anyway, and then it has this funny sort of shape that has isolated populations of animals, and also it changed the temperature such that it makes for a very, very diverse place. You can go up into the northern reaches, and it swings from temperate like San Francisco to tropical like Hawaii in the course of a year. And then you go down in the south, and you'll see a totally different group of fish and a totally different ecosystem in a very small area. And there's some shallow areas, there's deep rocky areas. It's a very diverse place, which is why there were so many different kinds of fish there when Jacques Cousteau visited.
Now, is the diversity decreasing, or just simply marine life in general?
Well, that's actually a really good point. It's important to think about the differences between tropical and temperate oceans. Temperate oceans, cold oceans, you know, off the coast of New York, you tend to see huge numbers of fish, you know, Atlantic cod, you know, lots and lots of fish, not as much diversity, but giant volumes, which lends itself to industrial fishing. You can go out with a bunch of big boats, and there's lots and lots of Atlantic cod. Now, obviously, Atlantic cod have disappeared, but generally speaking, you're talking about big numbers. Now, in the tropics, you have a lot more diversity and less volume. So, fishing for red snapper or you know, types of tuna that live in tropical waters, you're not going to see the depth in the populations that you would see in temperate waters.
My guest is Eric Vance, who is a science writer based in Mexico City. His article in Harper's Magazine, the August issue, is called Emptying the World's Aquarium, The Dismal Future of the Global Fishery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The northern part of the Sea of Cortez was traditionally fed by the Colorado River, but hasn't that begun to dry up?
It's actually finished drying up. It's pretty amazing. Depending on when you want to when you want to, you know, stick the pin in it. You know, it dried up sometime in the late 90s, probably. And when you drive past it now, it used to be a verdant wetland that sprawled out for miles and miles and miles with cottonwoods and all kinds of, you know, water-loving plants. And now it's a desert, unlike other deserts in Baja. It's you know, full of salt, and this Colorado River no longer reaches the Sea of Cortez in any way that you and I would think of a river reaching the sea.
Are factors like pollution or climate change at play here as well?
Climate change is less at play here. Certainly, the locals are always on the lookout for climate issues. Pollution, definitely in local areas, you know, around some of the shrimp farms, there are some pollution issues. Around some of the hotels, there's pollution. But the overwhelming issue is overfishing, and it's the fishing methods and the fishing practices that really have affected the Sea of Cortez.
But didn't the Mexican government create a large marine preserve in the northern portion of the Sea of Cortez?
Yes,
it did. Has that had any impact?
Yes, actually, it's had two very large impacts. So in relation to signing NAFTA, one of the things that happened was Mexico had a strong desire to focus on some creatures that were of interest to both countries, or maybe all three countries, and protect them. And so they created this huge preserve in the northern part of the Sea of Cortez around an animal called the vaquita, which is also called the Mexican porpoise. It's currently the rarest or the most endangered marine mammal in the world, and there's only a couple hundred of them left, and they're really hard to see. So they created this massive park that and they basically pushed out about half the fishermen and cut the number of trawlers down a phenomenal amount. And that succeeded in doing two things. One thing was the number of shrimp and fish caught in that we saw when we went there, that caught in this area, was far out of proportion from the rest of the Sea of Cortez. It was a much richer, much better catch. But the people there are extremely angry about the way they were treated. Their cousins, their family members were, you know, in some cases stripped of their permits. In other cases, they were paid with promises of ecotourism. And so the idea of being able to cooperate with these people again, or being able to have them police themselves, is hard to imagine, because the Mexican government actually spends a lot of money policing this area. It's a very energy intensive endeavor, and it's something that, given how angry the locals are at the Mexican government, at scientists, and at nonprofits, it's very hard to imagine this being a model that would work in other parts of the country or other parts of the world, which is really what I'm interested in.
Now, are those fishermen the ones that are included in one of the two types of fishing fleets that operate in the Sea of Cortez, the small boats called pangas?
Mm-hmm.
The others are large commercial trawlers. I imagine they're coming from elsewhere.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. In some respects, you're right. The pangas don't have the kind of distance. They can't go that far. Imagine a Boston Whaler, maybe, or a 15-foot boat with an outboard motor. I mean, this is a very simple boat, and they can't go that far. So the panga fishermen tend to be from the direct area, whereas the barcos, as they call them, or the big trawlers, go out for months at a time, and they'll crisscross the Sea of Cortez several times before they come back and then dump off all of their usually shrimp or sardines. But if you put the workers of a barco or a trawler out of work, they're going to go out, get a panga, and become panga fishermen. So there's a lot of back and forth, and when they, you know, start up a new trawler, they hire from the panga fleet. The difference is in the equipment they use to catch the fish, and in the regulations that are applied to the two types of boats. There are limited regulations on the trawlers. Mexican government is able to say, you can't use this kind of net, you have to use this kind of net. And most of the time they have to kind of follow the rules, and it's hit or miss. But with the pangas, there's no controls. There's no one in most of Mexico. There's no one really checking in on, you know, these guys. You know, the local fisherman down the street who fishes with his cousin every morning, uses a couple hundred yards of net, and then brings in anywhere from say 20 to maybe a couple hundred dollars worth of fish in a day.
So they can't have all that much of an impact on the biodiversity that you're writing about, can they?
This is a big question. This is sort of the golden question in many ways. Now, there's 25,000 pangas in the Sea of Cortez, and there's about 1,300 trawlers, and that number is actually going down. The trawlers are fast going out of business because they can't. There's not that many fish left to catch. So the 25,000 is a big number, and what we saw, you know, you go out on the height of shrimp season, and the horizon is just littered with these small boats. As far as you can see, each boat's got, you know, a few football field size net, and the boats that we were in, a lot of people think that the pangas don't have a bycatch problem. Bycatch is all the animals that you catch that you don't want, you chuck overboard and probably die. So these are things that we're not eating, and they're just going to waste. And people say the pangas don't have a bycatch problem, but we saw a lot more bycatch than sort of target food, you know, in this case shrimp. They didn't catch nearly as much shrimp as they did other stuff, which certainly didn't survive being caught in the net and then ripped out of the net.
What about dolphins? Are they ever caught as part of the bycatch?
Yes. Well, some dolphins. Yes, the vaquita is a good example. Now, this particular type of porpoise, it's a real shame. You know, this very rare porpoise is not good at avoiding the nets. Other dolphins can avoid the net. Some animals, you know, turtles have trouble avoiding the nets. Sharks have trouble avoiding these nets. Sea lions don't. So the animals that, for whatever reason, the water up in the upper Gulf is very murky, so it's very hard to see these things. And that's even for a dolphin with their high echolocation acuity, you know, they can't. It's very hard to see these things. So they do get caught, and you do get these bycatch. You know, a lot of the biomass loss in the Sea of Cortez has been from these big, cool animals that we all know and would recognize.
Now, they're mostly going after shrimp. What other species of fish are they trying to catch?
Well, the shrimp is the famous one. It's often referred to as pink gold in the area because it's, and a few years ago it was so valuable that you'd see lawyers and doctors during the shrimp season, like, running down with all of their fishing gear because it was just so valuable. You know, these people who the rest of the year had other jobs would be fishing. So that's the most famous one.
What about abalone? I've spoken to some Chinese chefs who say that you can't get abalone from Asia anymore. They got it all from Mexico, from Baja.
Yeah, abalone is a good question.
It's really expensive.
Yeah, it would be really expensive. That particular one, I'm thinking maybe in the south. Generally, it's more on the Pacific open water side. Sea of Cortez is a very different environment from the Pacific side, but abalone tends to be in colder waters. The equivalent that we saw would have been callo, which is a little like a scallop, only the shell's a lot bigger. And those are things that are caught by fishermen by hand. They go underwater, they scuba dive, and they pull these things like out of the mud one at a time, which is really amazing to watch because these guys are, you know, they're murky, they're looking around for these things that are very hard to see, and pulling them out. So that's another thing. Is a good point. There's a lot of other fish that, like sardines. There was a fish that was nearly driven to extinction called the totoaba, which is also very popular in China and Asia. And there's a story just the other day about how they're still in demand. That's sort of a type of drum. What else? There's also sea cucumbers, which is a disgusting-looking creature that a lot of, in Asian markets, a lot of people eat. And there's even jellyfish, which is a new phenomenon of people buying and selling this jellyfish, which was never in the Sea of Cortez before, but today has kind of slipped in and filled the void left by all the other animals that are gone, and now people have found a market to sell and eat jellyfish, which is a scary thought because they don't taste real good, and 20 years from now, I don't want to be eating only jellyfish. But there's a whole host of other things that that get pulled out of the Sea of Cortez, and you can imagine that the history of sharks is another big one. Tuna down south. There's anything you can imagine. At one point or another, we've gotten from the Sea of Cortez.
I have to defend jellyfish. If it's treated in a certain way, it's a delicacy in Chinese restaurants. My guest is
Have you had it?
Yeah, of course.
How does it taste? I have not had it.
It's just a little chewy, but people think it's okay until they're told it's jellyfish. Eric Vance is my guest. His article, Emptying the World's Aquarium, The Dismal Future of the Global Fishery, which was supported, his work was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. It's in the August 2013 issue of Harper's Magazine, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Don't go away, Eric. Be right back. And we are back with Eric Vance. His article, Emptying the World's Aquarium, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. While you were researching this article, you spent several months in Baja interviewing panga fishermen. Do they feel that the sea is being overfished? Do they notice a decline in the populations of marine life?
Yeah, well, and before I mention that, I do want to say, before the break, you mentioned the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, and the reason we were allowed to go for 2 months and really, really immerse ourselves in some of these places was because they supported our work, and this kind of thing just can't happen these days without help from outside funding, so I just can't speak highly enough about the support we got from the Pulitzer Center in allowing, you know, in paying for us to go out and spend a lot of time with these fishermen. And we're actually going back just because there's so much more to learn. The fishermen, when you ask them, they sort of had two responses. The older fishermen certainly say, oh, yeah, you know, I remember when there was this kind of fish and now we don't catch that fish. I remember not going as far to catch fish. And that's a common phrase because that these are the ways you can see if a population is crashing. It's not just if there's less in the net. It's also how far you have to go to get them. So that's a common refrain. We're running out of fish. What do we do? What do we do? We're running out of fish.
Well, do they see themselves as being part of the problem?
No. Usually they point to trawlers or other people from Oaxaca or places outside who've come into the area who've also run out of fish, and they say, you know, these people from the outside, they're the problem. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, banning certain groups of people, always with the idea of, you know, me and my family still get to stay and fish. But a few people who are very reflective say, you know, we understand that we're a part of this, but, you know, to give the oceans a break, what are we going to do? How are we going to support ourselves? The Mexican government has worked very hard to actually push people towards fishing, and to the point where there's probably too many fishermen there. But you can't just say, okay, don't fish.
Well, Mexico has more seacoast than the United States does.
Yeah.
Seafood is a major part of the diet of many Mexicans.
It is now. Traditionally, it actually was not. You know, even 40 years ago, it was all for export. And it's only recently that, you know, the sort of Baja style of food, you know, where I live in Mexico City, where that has really become very popular, maybe in this last generation. But traditionally, no, you know, for most of Mexico, it's, you know, corn sort of was king. But you're right. And most of that fish, actually, a good half of that fish comes from the Sea of Cortez. It's by far the richest place, potentially in North America, but certainly in Mexico for fishing. So this is not a small, you know, obscure place. This is a very important place. And for years, there's something called Marcha al Mar, which is the Mexican government has, when people are out of work, tried to, you know, push them by giving them grants and loans into becoming fishermen, because then they're not unemployed anymore. $10,000 for a boat, and they're not unemployed. And you no longer have to worry about, you know, the unemployment problem.
Well, don't
that, and that has, go ahead.
No, you know, finish your point.
That has had an effect on what I saw was a a lot of fishermen for a small area. I mean, it's just, they're really packed in. There's a lot of these small little fishing camps, and it's a lot of people who've been doing it for the last 50 years.
Still, if the panga fishermen were there alone, the probably wouldn't be as dire. The large industrial trawlers, they drag their nets across the bottom of the sea and on the seafloor, and that has not only picks up a lot of stuff, but also has an effect on the ecosystem, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it definitely, I mean, you know, the first time that like on a barco or a trawler goes through, they, you know, in the net, they get a lot of, you know, corals and different, you know, sponges and things that were sort of steamrolled off the bottom. And then the next time they come through, of course, they don't, because those things are gone, which then affects people's ability to actually judge what was there originally in the first place. So it's, yeah, there is that different effect. But at the same time, the barcos actually go to the deeper water. So, you know, some of them aren't always, you know, scraping the floor. And the pangas, it's hard to know if you could get rid of all the pangas or if you could get rid of all the barcos, what would happen. I think there needs to be more of a holistic approach, because neither of those things are going to happen. And so it's, you know, pointing fingers has been going on for decades now, and it's not really helping very much, with the panga saying it's your fault and the barco saying it's your fault.
In response to commercial fishing in their home waters, the indigenous Seri community formed a group called the Guardia Tradicional. What can you tell us about them? What do they do?
Well, it's an interesting. So the Seri waters, it's a indigenous group who live along the coast. Traditionally, they were they moved from place to place, and over the past 50 years, over the past 100 years, the Mexican government spent a lot of time trying to eradicate them, and they really have a history of amazing resistance against who they call the Spanish, who at that point, you know, we'd call the Mexican government. You know, trying to remove them from this land and them really, really fighting back hard. So they have this tradition of setting their own rules. And in recent decades, they've become fishermen and they've stopped moving around as much. And they really see this one channel in between the mainland and a place called Tiburon Island, which is the biggest island in the Sea of Cortez. You can see it on Google Maps really easily, as their place. And they do have rights to all the land that abuts that area. They don't necessarily have legal right to the water itself, but they see themselves as having that right, and they see themselves as stewards of the ocean in a better way than all the rest of the towns around them. And it's hard to argue that, because there are more fish in their territory than there are in other places.
On the other hand, some members of the group have been known to sell permits to trawling operations.
Right. So there's two towns, and a lot has been made about these Guardia and how they go out and they're eco-warriors. More what I saw was there are these two towns. One town has decided that they can make money, and this is not a lot of money. This is a couple $1,000s for a permit or less, by allowing these barcos to come in and fish on the other town's waters. So there's a lot of hostility, not only towards the outside, but within the community. And what we saw was the Guardia sort of around one town, but sort of leading the other town off to kind of fend for itself. That town is called Desemboque. And the people there have taken to boarding some of the trawlers and demanding sort of a tax or a couple crates of shrimp as payment. But then they also describe just the phenomenal devastation that washes up on their shore every time one of these trawlers comes through. I mean, it's, you know, the next day, the shores are full of dead fish. So it's, you know, there's this notion that these people are sort of fighting back and they're these eco-warriors. But what I saw was, the Guardia themselves actually say they're more interested in the bighorn sheep than the fish when we talk to them. So it's not a solution. It's not something that we saw as a way to nearly as exciting as we were sort of hoping it would be. It just seems like it's the last-ditch effort to protect you know, these waters that you see just getting decimated of wildlife.
Well, the Somali pirates claim that they turned to piracy because their traditional livelihoods as fishermen have been destroyed by commercial fishing operations. Has the destruction of the fishery led to criminal activities in the Sea of Cortez as well? Are we seeing drug cartels operating in the region?
We are seeing drug cartels passing product through the region, and like any place in Mexico, the trade routes are always changing. And so when we were there, the fishermen told us that a few years before, and you always have to be careful with these things because we don't want to get anyone in any trouble with the local narcos. But a few years before, the narcos had started coming in. Narcos are the drug dealers or the drug cartels. They had come in and they had started using the fishermen as couriers or as scouts, or sometimes even to fetch product off the bottom of the water where it had been tossed during a chase. So you're being chased by the police, you toss your drugs overboard, a fisherman comes and hunts it down later. So that's as far as we've directly sort of detected, but there's also a lot of talk about these trawlers being full up of drugs and working their way north from sort of the southern part of Mexico through the Sea of Cortez, or even around the Pacific side. But the Pacific side's a lot rougher, so it's better if you can go up the Sea of Cortez and then either traveling over land, or actually there've been a lot of stories of pangas going from Mexico all the way up to San Luis Obispo, which is halfway to San Francisco, and dropping drugs off there. So there's a lot of ocean routes involved in these drug pathways, and the fishermen are a big part of that.
Well, back to the legitimate fishing. Where's the biggest market for the things that are being caught in the Sea of Cortez? Is it mostly Asians who've come to depend on the area because they've already overfished their own waters, or is it Mexico? Is it California?
It's easy to say that, and that's actually why I focused on the Sea of Cortez as well, because it is sort of imagine this pincher hold between the United States and then the Chinese, Japanese, and Korean markets are huge markets for seafood, and the Sea of Cortez is sort of perfectly positioned for both of those, and the Japanese and the Korean markets have been very active in the Sea of Cortez, going all the way back to John Steinbeck, and he was talking about seeing these things on the water. And the United States has obviously been a huge player. The difference is now China has really tremendously increased the demand for fish, and so that's, you know, it's hard to blame China because they're sort of coming up to where the United States has been this whole time. We are still a big eater of fish, and shrimp especially. Shrimp is our favorite seafood, we have to remember. And so it's not the shrimp that are disappearing, but it's everything that gets caught along with them. And a lot of that goes back to what's on our plates. But yes, the Asian markets are the biggest change.
Now, Eric, we don't have a lot of time, but sure. I was wondering about aquaculture. Fish farms, are they popping up in the area?
They are. They're popping up all over the world. And China is actually also the biggest player in aquaculture. They are popping up. There are problems associated with those. And the two big ones are pollution. But the bigger one is, what are they going to eat? What are you going to feed to these fish or shrimp that you're putting in a pond? The answer is fish that you catch out in the wild. And sometimes many times as much weight in food needs to go in that comes out. So it's not a solution if you have to feed these things wild fish that you caught in order to get them to grow.
Now, there are certain species of fish that we have been told we should try to stay away from until they recover their populations. Are there any from this area that we might think twice about eating?
Well, and I think you're referring to the sustainable fish movement, and it's it's very difficult to, I think it's more important to think of that as sort of big choices in your eating. And I've written about this before. I mean, shrimp, I could easily say we shouldn't eat shrimp until we can figure out a better way to catch them that doesn't decimate so many other creatures that live nearby.
Well, we've lost so many in the Gulf of Mexico because of oil spills. I'd imagine Mexico is filling some of that vacuum.
It is. It is. And certainly fishermen and distributors in the Gulf of California are quick to point out that there, you know, there's no oil in their shrimp, which, from what I understand, is not a problem with, you know, that problem isn't worked out for a lot of the shrimp that you're eating in the Gulf of Mexico and that those fish are actually clean now. But there are most of the fish that we eat in restaurants in the United States. And the choices we make have a direct impact, probably more than any other kind of food that we eat, on the animals and the wildlife.
We have a link to Eric Vance's piece on our show page at WNYC.org, Emptying the World's Aquarium. It's in the August issue of Harper's Magazine.